This interview with Noam Chomsky was recorded on October 16, 2002, and broadcast on October 17 on Doug Henwood's show Behind the News on WBAI, New York. Noam Chomsky. What do you read as the
motives of the Bush war cry against Iraq? Is it oil? Is it geostrategic? Is it domestic politics?
I think all are involved. Anything involving that region of the world, we can be quite confident that oil is a major factor. It's been understood for a long time that by far the most abundant and easily accessible energy resources in the world, oil resources, are in the Persian Gulf region. And after the Second World War, the U.S. Was determined to take control over them. The State Department regarded them as, quoted, stupendous source of strategic power and one of the greatest material prizes in world history. The U.S. itself didn't need the oil, in fact didn't use it. North America was the main producer up until around 1970, but it wanted control over it. And the reasons have to do in part just with the enormous profits that come, but also because, and it isn't just oil companies, it's also the return of massive petrodollar flows to the United States for lots of different ways, but also because, as they pointed out, it's a source of strategic power. It's a lever of world control. You control the energy resources. You have a tremendous influence over the world. So that's been true for a long time. Turning to Iraq, it has the second largest oil reserves in the world. A lot of it is unexplored, so there may be even more than people know. It's easily accessible. It's cheap. It's been pretty clear for a long time that the U.S. would somehow or other move to pursue the policies it has been committed to for over 50 years, namely restoring those resources back to U.S. control so they don't get wasted on their own population, but that the profits flow to the right sort of people, like people around Bush, and that the lever of world control is back in our hands. But that's a long-standing policy. It doesn't account for the timing of the current drive to war. And to look at the timing, I think we have to turn to the other factors you mentioned, primarily domestic, I think. First of all, September 11th gave a pretext. You know, there was, before that, it was hard to conjure up a reason that would sell. But after September 11th, you could provide very flimsy but pretexts, but at least maybe you can sell them. That's what the propaganda system's trying to do, connecting it to the so-called war on terror.
So there's a pretext. But most serious people, aside from the administration and Christopher Hitchens, don't seem to find much link between al-Qaeda and Iraq.
It's very unlikely that there's a link. I mean, Saddam Hussein and bin Laden are both monsters, but they're very different kinds of monsters. Saddam Hussein is secular. Osama bin Laden is a religious fanatic. I mean, they've hated each other for years. In fact, one of the reasons Osama bin Laden turned against the United States around 1990 was that the U.S. and Saudi Arabia wouldn't allow him to launch a jihad against Iraq. Scott Ritter pointed out recently, and he's probably right, that if Saddam were to give weapons of mass destruction to Osama, the first target would probably be Saddam. You know? Anyhow, no links have been found, and it's pretty unlikely. Not that, you know, they're both monsters. So there's a pretext, September 11th, and there's also a reason. The reason, I think, has to do with, I mean, just imagine yourself a Republican Party strategist. You're coming up to elections, say 2004. It's hardly a secret that the Bush administration is literally carrying out a serious assault against the population. These are recycled Reaganites, mostly. They did pretty much what they did in the early days of the Reagan administration. They drove the country into deep deficits, which have the good effect of undermining social spending. So Alan Greenspan can soberly talk about the need for fiscal discipline. What that translates into is tax cuts and other measures to benefit the extremely wealthy and crumbs for the rest. Well, they don't want people in early 2004 when the election campaign's going on. They do not. The last thing they want is for people to be asking questions about, you know, how do I take care of my elderly mother, or where's my pension, or other, you know, what what's happening to the environment, which my children might survive, or where's my job, and so on. They don't want those questions to be uppermost. In fact, they're uppermost right now, and there's a massive effort to suppress them by turning to war. And there's only one standard technique for getting people not to pay attention to what a hardline, right-wing, repressive regime is doing, and that's to terrorize them. You frighten them. You want them to be, by 2004, you want them to be cheering the grand leader who saved us from total destruction miraculously, and by then we'll be, you know, off on the next campaign. That's just so standard, it's hardly even worth mentioning. It's the device that instantly comes to mind to any political leader who's trying to control a population. And they have a real need for it, because they are harming the population seriously. And I suspect that that's the prime motive for the timing. The war has to be over the winter for technical reasons, and they don't want it to be the winter of 2004, right in the middle of the presidential campaign. They want a victory by then. They want to be able to say, look, we destroyed the monster and saved, you know, saved the American people from destruction, and now we got to go on to the next one. And they also, having, you know, staked out a so-called war on terror as their prime commitment, they got to have a victory, and this could be one. The plans are much more ambitious. If you look at what these guys have been writing and saying for years, they have extremely ambitious plans, not only for reconstructing the whole Middle East region, but going on beyond. Many of them want to go after China.
China is a much, much harder nut to crack. I mean, how can they possibly go after China?
So is Russia. I mean, they're within the administration, I don't want to say they're running the show, but within that group there are extremist, jingoist fanatics who say, look, we destroyed Russia, we can destroy China. In fact, we can take over the world by force. This is not just my view, incidentally. You can read it in very respectable mainstream sources. So take a look at Anatol Yevhen, a well-known, respected analyst who's a senior associate of the Carnegie Endowment. He just wrote an article about it in which he said that the U.S. is becoming, in his words, a menace to the world because of the intent of the long-term intent of these sectors, which is not a secret, to rely on their overwhelming military power to intimidate the rest of the world and dominate it. That's pretty much the message of the National Security Strategy document that came out, and they're very serious. They're also, with regard to the Middle East, they're very closely linked to the ultra-right wing in Israel. So people like Richard Perle, for example, have been told is called Darth Vader by the Washington Press Corps, who's a recycled Reaganite too. He's been, you know, he was writing position papers for Benjamin Netanyahu, who's to the right of Ariel Sharon. They have an idea about, they have ideas and about reconstructing the region, imposing what amounts to a kind of Ottomanization of the region with major power centers in the prime power center, of course, is the U.S., but offshoots of the U.S., like Israel, which is by now practically a U.S. military base, and Turkey, though it's a little less reliable because it's more independent. So yes, that's a plan. It could work. They're probably already going after Iran. There's pretty good evidence for that, and that's likely next target. It's you know, could succeed for some time to come. Also, as in fact Yevhen correctly points out, part of the goal is to, as he puts it, to offload the ecological destruction that flows out of the American economy, to offload it onto the rest of the world without any cost to, you know, U.S. elites and U.S. capitalism. That's not an unserious point.
During the Clinton years, there was a more collegial, multilateral approach to running the world. They took allies and their opinions, at least on the surface of things, more seriously. What do you say about the contrast between that style and this aggressive America First style of the Bush crowd?
The Bush-Reagan crowd, because they are Reaganites. Yeah, there's a difference. Actually, Bush number one was closer to the Clinton style. Whatever you think about him, he was some kind of a statesman like Nixon. These people are at an extreme point of the spectrum, but it's a pretty narrow spectrum. Remember, so during the Clinton years, yeah, there were vows to internationalism, but say take the doctrine of preemptive strike, which is supposed to be new. Like, it's not new. Colin Powell's quite right when he says it has antecedents and they go far back. They could go right back to the Kennedy administration, for example, explicitly. But also in the Clinton years. So Clinton's strategic command in 1995 produced a very important document, their major study on what they called Essentials of Post-Cold War Deterrence. It's a horrifying document. I suppose that's why it's never discussed. But in it, you find the interesting notion of what they call preemptive response, including nuclear weapons. Preemptive response with nuclear weapons just means we attack anyone we like. Back 40 years ago, when Kennedy was, as he put it to his staff secretly, ordering them to unleash the terrors of the earth against Cuba, because of its successful defiance of the United States and an economic embargo and so on. Just at that time, Dean Acheson, senior statesman, addressed the American Society of International Law, 1962, and he instructed them, virtually quoting, that when the U.S. Responds to a challenge to its power, position, or prestige, no legal issue arises. That's not even protection against a threat, just a threat to a challenge to the U.S. position, power, or prestige. And that goes way beyond Bush, and that's the Kennedy administration. Publicly, incidentally.
What do you read as the state of Iraqi opinion? How popular is Saddam? Do you think that the population will at least initially welcome his being deposed?
Well, I don't, have no information, of course. But there are some good reporters there. Probably the best of them is Hugh Pope, who has a lot of background in the region, writes for the Wall Street Journal. He has a story this morning, actually I have it right in front of me, in which he says that he's there, he's wandering around like everybody. And he says that he finds, first of all, obviously the population is, not going to tell what they think with minders around. They're frightened. But he says partly what you have to concede is the Iraqi population feels solidarity with the regime while under the threat of U.S. attack. That's probably right. Does that mean they won't standing on rooftops welcoming U.S. troops? No, it doesn't. When a conquering army marches in, people usually cheer, no matter who it is. But that's no criterion.
You mentioned Israel earlier, and this is a matter of some controversy. There are people who argue that Israel has now outlived its strategic usefulness to the U.S. after the Cold War, and it would make sense to distance ourselves from Israel and make more friends in the Arab world. People who take this position often claim that the reason for the continuing loyalty to Israel is the strength of the Israeli lobby Jewish opinion in the U.S. What's your reaction to that?
The Israeli lobby, which is largely right-wing Christian fundamentalist, is significant. It's a swing of vote, and it has a swing effect. And because of its is extremely strong in intellectual opinion, which means there's a it sharply narrows discussion and debate. Nevertheless, I think one shouldn't exaggerate. It will not confront the U.S. government. We have example after example. When Washington wants something, it tells Israel it has to do it, and they do it, and the lobby disappears. I think it's there, and it's influential, but one shouldn't exaggerate. That's not the way U.S. domestic politics works. As for Israel's role in U.S. planning, I tend to agree with the high-level Israeli strategic analysts and the U.S. analysts who say that after the end of the collapse of the Soviet Union, its role simply increased because its role had nothing to do with protecting the Middle East against the Soviet Union. That was a pretext. In fact, the government's long ago conceded it. We don't really have to argue it. One of the most important documents that the first Bush administration produced was its message to Congress right after the fall of the Berlin Wall, its annual message to Congress calling for a huge military budget. Now, that's very interesting. What are they going to say now that the Russians are gone? Well, it is interesting. I wrote about it at the time. With regard to the Middle East, what they said is we must maintain the massive intervention forces that we've always had poised at the Middle East. Then comes the following phrase, where the threat to our interests that might require a military force could not be laid at the Kremlin's door. Okay, so it wasn't the Russians, contrary to what we've been telling you for 40 years. It's indigenous nationalism. And the rest of the document goes on to explain that. Notice, incidentally, that the threats couldn't be laid at Saddam Hussein's door either, because at that time he was a great friend and ally of George Bush. So it was indigenous nationalism, as it had been for a long time. And how do you control indigenous nationalism? Well, you know, back as far as 1958, U.S. intelligence recognized that what they said is a logical corollary of our opposition to Arab nationalism, which was then secular, a logical corollary is support for Israel as a reliable base for U.S. power in the region. Now, that was firmed up in 1967, and it's the basis for the U.S.-Israeli alliance since. Israel, alongside of Turkey and in earlier years Iran under the Shah, is what the Nixon administration called a local cop on the beat, not to protect anyone against the Russians, but to protect the corrupt and brutal regimes against their own populations. The U.S. understands the effects. So when Bush asks, why do they hate us, he knows he doesn't know the answer. His advisors surely do. Eisenhower brought the same thing up in 1958. He discussed with his staff what he called a campaign of hatred against us in the Arab world. The National Security Council gave the reasons, and they were right. They said it's based on a recognition in the region that the U.S. supports corrupt and oppressive regimes and blocks democracy and development, and we do so because of our interest in controlling Near East oil. That was correct then, and it remains correct now. And when that's the way of dealing with the region, yes, you're going to need powerful military bases. And Israel is not small. I mean, it's a small country, but not as a military force. According to the IDF, the Israeli army, their own analysts claim, probably rightly, that their air and naval forces are larger and more technologically advanced than those of any NATO power outside the U.S. About over 10% of them are now permanently based in eastern Turkey, along with armored forces in case they have to crush the Kurds again, their own local Kurds. And they're operating out of U.S. bases in eastern Turkey. According to U.S. specialists, they're flying over the Iranian border. That's their real target. This is a reliable base for U.S. power, and that has nothing to do with the Cold War.
The Europeans are filing some kind of objections to this Bush policy. What do you think the prospects are for their developing some kind of political and military independence from U.S. domination?
I think they would be making a big mistake if they tried to construct a military counter to the United States. That doesn't make any sense. Europe can be extremely influential in the world and powerful, but through what's sometimes called soft power, through its economy, its social system, its model, its other kinds of cultural influences and so on. That's extremely important. And in those respects, Europe is on a par with and maybe even more advanced than the United States. But they have to get their act together. They have to be willing to do it. And European elites are, you know, not dissatisfied with the situation in which they ride on the coattails of the U.S. and U.S. power. Maybe the populations will change that, just as we could change it here. but it's not going to come from elite opinion. There'll be some bleats of protest, but not much more than that. So take, say, the case of Iraq. Take, say, France. France is leading the protest against the U.S. measures, and we can be pretty confident, in fact, it's, you know, it's even stated in the press that the U.S. is working behind the scenes to assure France that after the U.S. takes over Iraq, it'll grant France a share in the control of the profits, at least, from Iraqi oil. And France will probably go along with that, just as Russia probably will. Europe could be independent, very influential, but the Europeans have to want it. They have to organize to do something about it, and those pressures are not going to come from elite sectors.
Turning to domestic effects of this permanent mobilization, you've said that you don't think that the threat to American civil liberties is all that great because the culture, political culture, is just so deeply habituated to it. Could you expand on that a little bit?
What I actually said, maybe not clearly enough, is that that's, I think that's true for people like you and me, and in fact for the large mainstream of U.S. society. But vulnerable people are in deep trouble. So immigrants, for example, if people like John Ashcroft have their way, and to an extent they're having it, the structure of civil liberties in the United States will be seriously undermined and probably demolished, but the targets will be the most vulnerable people. Actually, what's happening, and to go even more vulnerable, what's happening in Guantanamo now is outrageous. I mean, every fundamental principle of international humanitarian law, including the Geneva Conventions, is just being completely dismantled. Well, those people are without any protection. But immigrants, dark-skinned people, and others who are tend to be vulnerable, they may be in serious trouble. But I do think that a lot of rights have been won in the United States, not granted, but won after a long and hard struggle. And I don't think people are going to abandon them easily. I mean, take, say, freedom of speech. We sort of take it for granted. And in fact, the U.S. record is now very good, you know, maybe the best in the world. But that's not in the Bill of Rights. In fact, basic principles of freedom of speech weren't established by the Supreme Court until the 1960s in the course of the civil rights movement. And good that they were, but it's not graven in stone, and the background record is pretty ugly. But nevertheless, I think that those rights people aren't going to abandon easily, or others.
What about the state of public opinion about the war and the prospects for a peace movement? I don't detect a great enthusiasm to conquer Iraq. Do you see some hopeful signs of a growing peace movement? What's your thoughts on that?
Public is never very much interested in war any more than the top military brass is, but people can be frightened. After all, Reagan was frightening them with images of Nicaraguans 2 days marching time from Texas, and he did manage to create considerable fear. And people are frightened now. Under conditions of fear, people tend to support power. But, you know, the support's pretty thin. There's plenty of dissent and opposition and concern, and I think plenty of grounds for optimism for people who are trying to organize and work. It's certainly far easier now than it was, say, 40 years ago when Kennedy publicly launched the attack on South Vietnam. Then you couldn't do a thing. In the 1980s, the situation was better. You could organize for the wars against Nicaragua and the wars in El Salvador and Guatemala, but it wasn't that easy. I think now there's considerably more opportunity. Although, you know, the war drums are beating and people are scared.
You've also said that the country is more civilized than it was 40 years ago. What do you mean by that?
Incomparably more civilized. I mean, things we take for granted now didn't exist 40 years ago. So, for example, just take, say, aggression. When Kennedy announced publicly that the U.S. Air Force is bombing South Vietnam, 1962, began using chemical weapons to destroy food crops, began programs to drive millions of people into what amounted to concentration camps. There was no protest. Nobody could talk. We didn't talk about it. Just took for granted that that's fine. In the 1960s, there was no feminist, barely a feminist movement, no environmental movement. In the 1960s, there wasn't yet, after hundreds of years, even the beginning of recognition of the original sin. What happened to the millions of people who used to live here? That's all changed. You know, it changed not so much in the 60s, but in the 70s and the 80s and since. That's when the major popular movements developed that have they haven't carried out institutional change, but they've changed the culture and the kind of moral level of the society very significantly. And those are real achievements. They make things very different than they were in the past. Among intellectuals, I don't think anything's changed, but it rarely does. But among the general population, I think it's correct to say that the level of civilization is much higher. Things that would have been considered perfectly appropriate then are outlandish now.
All right, that's a good note to end on. Thanks for joining us now, Chomsky.